Be who you want to be. Reach for the stars. Visit www.apprenticeships.org.uk.
So it is indeed Wednesday, the 8th of February, 2012. Good evening, it's Junior Saunders here on the Be Who You Want To Be show on Bristol's number one urban station, Ujima 98 FM. And remember, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If you want to find out anything more about apprenticeships, go to www.apprenticeships.org.uk. And if you do want to listen back to 3 weeks worth of your favourite shows, then also you can do it via the website, www.ujimaradio.com. So this week, we're going to be doing things a tiny bit different. Usually, we talk about apprenticeships and go into opportunities, etc. But this week, we're going to do something very, very special. Now, he needs no introducing, as he is an icon in Bristol. He goes by the name of Tony Gosling. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Junior.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine. For those that don't know much about me, I do another show on Bristol Community Radio, BCFM, a politics programme, where we have a politician on between 5 and 6 on a Friday, have a chat to them and interrogate them a little bit. Ask them, particularly the Conservatives, we ask, why have we got a government by the millionaires for the millionaires?
Ooh, interesting!
And the other thing is, why have we got these Bullingdon Club people in the cabinet, which is this elite club of thugs from Oxford. Actually, that's what they were doing. They would go into pubs and smash them up when they were undergraduates, almost all from Eton as well. They're basically stealing from the poor to give to the rich. So why have we got this kind of a government? And if you remember the old Monty Python sketch, Dennis Moore, it was a whole Mickey take by Monty Python, but this is where the world we seem to be living now. It's all become a bit surreal. So we do the politics in the first hour, and then in the second hour we extend things a little bit and look, sort of a bit more in depth. The politician moves out of the room, and we do some investigative journalism of one sort or another. So that's what I do on a Friday.
So Tony, where are we at the moment in terms of economic climate, in terms of our morale, in terms of
morale,
our vision?
Where are we? The key word is morale, and I tell you what, the whole country's getting a morale boost tonight. Right,
because yes.
a show called, not just your show.
No, not all about that.
A show called 10 o'clock live is on, and it's this new series starting tonight. I think it's 10 o'clock, and I shouldn't say this on Ujima, but there may be another thing to listen to later on tonight. You might have to switch Ujima off, even, and another radio station off, and watch the telly. I mean, most of us, I suppose, in the city who are pretty switched on, we don't watch that much TV because we don't believe much TV. We're not into the soap operas. But this is a live comedy show put together by people like Charlie Brooker, there's all sorts of other people, and one of the script editors I know, and they are really top people. And as far as I'm concerned, satire is where it's at, because satire is the big morale boost. So this punches through some of the nonsense politics we're getting nowadays. I mean, a lot of this stuff we've been seeing about Syria, for example, I mean, I don't know how much you follow this stuff,
but we've been
looking at, I mean, there was a, right throughout January, the Arab League were crawling all over Damascus, all over Syria, looking at what was going on. They were going to come up with a report. What happened to the report? The British media hasn't reported it. The mainstream media hasn't reported it at all. Mm. Actually, it's out there on the internet. You have to go to the internet and read it. And the main criticism of the Arab League was the mainstream media, because the Arab League were going around Damascus and other cities, and Homs included, looking for various things that have been reported by the mainstream media. And at least 50% of the attacks and massacres and things that were supposed to be happening in Syria, they turned up and they found nothing had happened at all. This was just lies from the mainstream media. And this is one of the reasons I think we do need a morale boost. When you're watching the news every evening, you're thinking, you're scratching your head and thinking, do I believe that?
Yeah.
Is that real? Is that true?
Well, look at Obama. No, sorry, not Obama. What am I talking about? Well, yeah, Obama's one thing. Sorry, Bin Laden. That's what I was going to say. You know, he died and all of a sudden nobody's seen him. But then Gaddafi, he was exploited everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the thing is, as well, with Bin Laden, is there are questions over whether he was really killed in that particular place at all.
Right.
Because the guy had serious kidney complaints around the time of September the 11th attacks back in 2001. And in fact, I went on a radio show at the morning after the attack and put forward some theories saying, for example, his funeral was announced in an Afghani newspaper just a couple of months after the September the 11th attacks. There are some serious, very well-sourced people who would say that Bin Laden has been dead for years and years, and this is a sort of media bogeyman that's been put out there. And also that the attack itself, there's a famous picture of Hillary Clinton and all the American dignitaries looking at a TV screen. But the camera is actually behind the TV screen, so you can't actually see what they're looking at. Now, it's been admitted since that that photograph, which was in all the newspapers at the time of this so-called killing of bin Laden, was staged. That actually it was done for the Pentagon news people.
Really?
So that nobody... they've actually admitted that, we had to stage this because they were questioning what was on this feed that you were all supposedly watching. So there are big questions about what we're being told about what's going on in the world around me. We certainly know what's going on in St. Paul's because we live here. We know what's going on. But when it starts getting like halfway around the world, you really do have to trust your mainstream media. And I'm afraid I'm really becoming more and more sceptical about... particularly some of the foreign policy stuff that we're seeing on our TV screens. I mean, it's a very powerful medium, and some people out there are ruthless enough to use it for their own purposes if they decide that they want a bit of oil.
Now, you're quite an open person. You know, they say you can read somebody within 30 seconds or 20 seconds, and obviously you have a very strong presence. So I want to throw you off tangent a little bit because I just want to get your view on this. When I say the word Anunnaki to you, what comes to mind? What comes to fruition?
I tell you what comes to mind is aliens.
Right. Okay, and what's your view on that?
Well, my view on the alien thing is, if there were aliens out there, we would have come across them a long time ago. Now, just statistically, right? If a new life form is growing up in somewhere else in the universe, right, in the big scheme of things, in the whole history of the universe, they would be easily detectable because it doesn't take very long in the big scheme of things, the history of the universe, for a life to go from one small source to actually spreading out and spreading out. It doesn't take very long. It may be millions of years. Of course, that seems like a long time to us, but in the big scheme of things, it's not. So I don't believe any of that.
So you believe there's no other life forms that live beyond the universe? That we can detect as human beings.
Well, there's nothing outside planet Earth. I mean, we hear again and again. I mean, like even on the news tonight, there was something about maybe there's life on Mars. I think right. This is actually a psychological tool to make us think less and less about what we're doing down here and make us feel less and less empowered to do our own thing and to change things. We're thinking, what are the aliens going to do next? You know, and actually, there's lots of reasons. I mean, you know, we hear this stuff about chemtrails. I mean, you must have come across that, where the people are talking about these spraying in the sky. It's almost impossible to tell what's going on there because it's right up in the sky. How are you going to go up 30,000 feet and check whether it's just an ice crystal that's in a contrail come out the back of a plane or a nasty chemical? You can't.
So the pyramids and the Nazca lines, what are your views on those?
Pyramids?
Yep.
Pyramids. Is there a sign of the civilization which dominated this planet, you know, sort of 3,000 years ago or so? I mean, we had our equivalent here in Britain. We had the Druids. But we didn't have pyramids, as far as I know. This was basically a religion which was all over the world, as far as I can tell.
Right.
I think it's also possible that there were some technologies that were had by these people. But I think, to be honest with you, they were basically a fear cult that used to operate by the fear that you may be sacrificed. I mean, this is what used to... I mean, certainly in Britain, we used to have human sacrifice, but, you know, back 3,000 years ago, there's very clear evidence of that. People having had their skulls smashed through, like buried, being poisoned as well. People have been found in the ritual burial chambers having been poisoned. So there were all sorts of weird stuff going on there. And I think in a way that these wars that we're seeing in places like Libya, etc., is almost a reflection of trying to create power through fear, through bloodshed. And this a lot of people recoil from this, you know. Surely we can't have this. And it does give a sort of a power to the people who are doing it, because no one dares to touch them. We're living in a world of impunity. Blair should be in jail, as far as I can tell. The man's a war criminal. He started an illegal war on something called weapons of mass destruction, which is a total lie. As we know, there were no weapons of mass destruction.
So how do you think the Twin Towers went down then?
The Twin Towers, well, 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, Sir Alan Sobrowski, who's a Jewish American, he was the head of the U.S. Army War College. He says it was Mossad that did it, and it's absolutely clear. The U.S. Army War College, let's remember, is quite an august institution in America. They're teaching all of the young officer recruits about intelligence work and all sorts of other things, the practice of war in the U.S., and he believes that it was actually the Israeli Secret Service that planned the operation. Now, I'm not saying it was or it wasn't, but I'm interested that the guy who was the head of the U.S. Army War College thinks that. We haven't heard that on Channel 4 News. We haven't heard that on the BBC. But it's definitely out there on the internet, and this guy is being absolutely clear about what he's saying. that he doesn't, he believes it was some kind of an inside job.
Right.
Either people within the US, the hawks within the US that want an excuse for war, or else in conjunction with other secret services in other parts of the world. And of course, it is feasible that something like this has happened. Certainly, I don't believe that the Twin Towers came down due to fire. If you listen to the recordings of the firemen who were actually up there, when those recordings are out there, they do exist, they were basically saying, we're about to put the fire out. One more hose reel up here, 10 minutes, and it'll be all over. The fire was nearly out.
Really?
Those guys died when the buildings came down. Certainly what looks to me to have been some kind of pre-planting of explosives in the buildings. In fact, there is a British guy who worked over there in the Twin Towers who I interviewed. And that interview's got so many downloads on the internet, it's unbelievable. But anyway,
that's good.
He said that there was a power down. He was a computer expert. He was a software engineer. And he was brought in the weekend before 9/11. To bring all the computers in his company down for the weekend because there were people in the building doing some wiring, apparently. And he saw them. He saw them in the lobbies and the lower floors. They were going through the building doing so they had over 24 hours with no power. That means no CCTV, no control over who's coming in or out of the Twin Towers beforehand. So it's quite possible that that was used as an opportunity to, you know, sort of put explosives, or wire the building for explosives of some sort. The Port Authority completely deny that there was a power down, which is driving him nuts because he's writing letters to everybody saying, look, there was a power down. That's what I did that weekend. The only reason he survived, let's say, is because he had a day off on the Tuesday in lieu, a day off in lieu, because he'd been working through the weekend to bring all the computers down and bring them back up again. So there's all sorts of dodgy stuff to do with September 11th attacks. It's slowly filtering out. Certainly the young people, if you go to Hartcliffe, most people know in Hartcliffe, you know, this is the rougher end of Bristol, because these people are very sceptical about what we're being told by the mainstream press about a lot of these big world events.
So what's your views on young people in politics? Why are young people so disengaged with politics?
Well, because the same reason a lot of middle-aged people have been disengaged with politics. If you go back to around about the time of the Second World War, just after World War II, you had something like 85, 90% of people voting. Nowadays, it's way, way, way down, sometimes less than 50%, 35%, in by-elections, even less. And the reason for that is because they don't actually see change coming when they do go and vote. They don't necessarily have any parties that really they feel represent them. And I think it's quite right to say that on certain key issues, like some of the important reforms we need, you know, like reforming the money system.
Yeah.
What we see is the Liberal Democrat Party, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, none of them actually coming up with the goods. My colleague Martin Summers, who's an old Labour Oxford economist who's on my programme, he's constantly repeating, he said, well, look, the problem is, it's going to have to be a crash before people realise we do need radical change in the way we organise our money system. Because essentially, the City of London has bought all the three main political parties. A lot of the city backers fund those political parties. And whereas we get a vote once every 4 years in a general election, those lobbyists from the City of London are knocking on the politician's door almost 24 hours a day. If they're not doing the right thing, then they get a hard time. Knock, 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 they're on the door again. Hang on a minute.
Yeah. So let me ask you something, another question, because I'm just exuding with questions at the moment. How is a recession possible? When you hear a perpetuated picture to say, you know, that we're in a recession, there is no money, how is it possible when money is numbers?
Well, money is just numbers, and these banks do something which is called fractional reserve. That means to say that they actually spend into the economy and loan into the economy far more money than they actually have in deposits. So it's, in a way, it's a racket. Yeah, being a bank is a racket. I spoke to someone a few weeks ago. He said, I tried to start a bank because I wanted to do it a bit differently, be more ethical. Impossible. Just can't do it. It's a closed shop. And it is a racket because these companies called banks are lending out money they don't have. In any other word, it would be called counterfeiting. If you or I were to try to do that, we'd be slapped in irons. But yeah, they are allowed to do it, yeah, because of whatever reason. It's almost like a banking cult. I would use such a strong word to call it as a cult, because it's like a very, very much a closed world, a closed society, and a closed club. So essentially, they run lines of credit out over, say, for example, during the 1990s and the noughties. They were running out these big lines of credit. 2007, 2008, they were starting to claw that money back. and they were trying to give out loans to people who they knew could never pay them back.
So do you think
in a way they're like loan
the
sharks, aren't right. they? They're like loan sharks. Yes, this wave of economic boom and bust does go up and down gently, about every 7 or 8 years, apparently. But this time, they've blown the bubble, the debt bubble up so big, the loan bubble up so big.
So how
now
are we
it's
get
starting
out of this?
To collapse.
How are we going to get out of this?
Well, I don't know. All I can say is we need to have the Treasury, we need to have our political representatives take back control of the money system. Over the years, they have just relinquished more and more and more and more power to the city. Essentially, the way that money works now is a totally privatised system. What we need is we need the Treasury to be issuing money. And in which case, why not then go and build new hospitals for free? Yeah, we don't have to have a PFI when we're borrowing money off someone else, so another massive institution is making most of the money out of that public money that's spent on our hospital, like Southmead, for example. And so there are other ways of doing these things, and I think ultimately maybe Martin's right that there will have to be some sort of financial crisis before people say, well, actually, we really do need the government, our democratic representatives in some way or other, to take back control. Then they can start spending on what we want rather than what the city wants.
But some would beg to differ that it's the reason there is a collapse at the moment is because we need to essentially go back to our roots. We need to go back to the collective mind, and we need to go within in order to project.
Well,
out
yes,
again.
But there's a historical thing here as well, Junior, right? A really important historical thing, and that is that Britain has been a boom country for about 200 years, actually. There's been pretty good employment, apart from a gap in the 1920s, in late 20s and early 30s. We've had pretty much full employment. So if you go back far enough, you'll find that most of our employees, most of the people we are now, were thrown off the land as land was enclosed, basically privatised in the sort of 1600s, 1700s. People used to live in villages. They had their own little bit of land. They had their own home. They didn't have to pay rent to anybody. Mm. And as they were evicted from their homes, kicked off the land, so they were the fuel for the Industrial Revolution. They were the people who were actually working in factories. Yeah, so that's why we had an industrial revolution in Britain, because we were the first country in the world to go for mass urbanisation. And we kicked everybody off the land, evicted them, basically, to make way for sheep, because sheep produce more money, more wool, etc., cheaper than the rents you can get off people if you're putting them on the land. So we had this pool of unemployed people, and they would willingly go and work in the factories. The only thing is, you go around Britain now, how many factories do you see? You see them closing and closing, especially up north. And so we need to find a new thing to do with all these people who are out there unemployed. We've got 120,000 more people on the dole in the last 3 months. This is 120,000. And now we're talking about austerity measures, which include welfare cuts, which are going to make 80,000, this is according to the Children's Society, 80,000 children homeless in Britain. This is no mean thing that Mr. Cameron and Mr. Clegg are doing. In fact, I think, by the way, Mr. Clegg is David Cameron's human shield. Every time there's a nasty announcement, Mr. Clegg seems to be the one that's taking the flak for it. Cameron's sort of off somewhere else, maybe on a trip to China or somewhere else. But so, you know, there's some big changes going on with the National Health Service as well. And so we are in really quite a nasty situation that we can't pay our bills nationally. The government's getting less and less tax in. And the quality of life is taking a nosedive, which is why I say what seems to be going on is complete and utter misrule from the top down. And I think this is one of the reasons we've had the riots, is because actually that misrule is trickling down.
So we was discussing a lot of things, from Anunnakis to political movements. It was quite interesting from the first half of it. But going into something that we just finished on a second ago, the riots. Now, there's a lot of premise around the riots starting to do with the, I'm going to say the assassination of Mark Duggan in London. And then that, you know, transcended through the country, a movement. Do you think that was the main cause, or do you believe that there was another agenda in people's brains when the riots happened last year?
Well, I think a lot of what's going on at the moment is we're being hit at a subconscious level, basically. There is a tension growing between the rich and the poor, so, and a sense of injustice. So what happens is events like the murder of Mark Duggan acts like a fuse, particularly because his friends and family and many, many people from Tottenham went to the police station that day to demand to know what was going on, what had happened, who was responsible, etc., and got absolutely no proper response from the police whatsoever. That all of the ideas of sort of community liaison, this kind of thing, were thrown out of the window that day. And I think the anger is absolutely normal and natural. But I'm in two minds as to whether this was an accident or whether it was absolutely deliberate murder by the police in order to spark something. Certainly there would have been a lot of police, you know, and others looking at what was going on around the country. My feeling also was that there was a deliberate inaction by the police for about 3 or 4 days. I mean, certainly here in Bristol, by the Tuesday, it was the Tuesday evening, I was going out every evening, and you could see there was a few problems actually happening here in Bristol as well, yeah, as in other parts
Cabot
of the country.
Circus, that was a prime example.
And then on the Tuesday, I think it was it Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 3 days after the killing of Duggan, then suddenly the police were everywhere. Yeah, every 100, 200 yards, there was a police riot van with riot police in it. And in that gap, I think it was actually a deliberate attempt. Now, this may have been a political thing by the police as well, because they're suffering from the austerity cuts, just like everybody else. In a way, it's their way of saying, so you really do need the police, don't you? Is it a good idea to cut the police at this point? And it was a message to Theresa May, the Home Secretary, you know, to say that. But ultimately, the sense of injustice is what we need to fix. Yeah, I think this is absolutely crucial. And I don't see this being fixed by any of the real results that have come out of the rioting last year. I mean, particularly 2 out of the 3 Tottenham community liaison people have now resigned. So they have absolutely no confidence that the police are really dealing with the problems that caused the riots. There's only 1 left of these community liaison people. So, I mean, you look at, for example, this business with Harry Redknapp today being acquitted. Mm. I mean, we've had the Scotland Yard and the police have been going for somebody like that who's acquitted. Millions of pounds spent on a trial. And yet, we've had since 2008, something like 4,000 names the police have had of people whose phones have been hacked, including Millie Dowler, as mum, terrible, and various other people, including victims of the 7/7 London bombings, victims of 9/11, and others. 4,000 names that the police have absolutely refused to act on. So why is it that the police are going for sort of dud cases like Harry Redknapp, and not for cases where they've got prima facie evidence of wrongdoing and criminal activity? And that's what I mean when I say there's this culture of impunity. Mm. Basically, the mates of Scotland Yard, it seems, can get away with almost anything. And that's the sense of injustice which has fueled those riots. At least that's what I can see. And until we address the real serious problems with particularly the Metropolitan Police, and I wouldn't class Avon and Somerset Police around here in the same league by any means. I think, you know, particularly ordinary police on the ground are not in any way involved in this kind of corruption, is all you can call it. There's also the Crown Prosecution Service, which doesn't help, because that's another arm in the loop of actually getting a prosecution going. But until we see some prosecutions of really senior people, and I mean people like Tony Blair, actually, and other visiting prime ministers from around the world that seem to have been involved in this war on terror, some of the massive war crimes from that. Now, I don't think, I mean, for example, Henry Kissinger, he's a man who's been in many ways, you know, there's a lot of evidence. For example, he was responsible for the coup in the 1970s in Chile. He's the guy's a war criminal. In many countries he can't go, but he can walk into Britain. The same with Israelis. There's Zippy Livni, the woman who was the Israeli defence minister responsible for the massacre in Gaza a few years ago. She can walk the streets of London with impunity. Until we see the police tackling and prosecutors tackling these high-level criminals, I think we're always going to be in the situation
where... Do you think they will, though?
I think ultimately it will have to happen, right. Yes, because, you know, the whole situation that's led to those riots has not gone away. In fact, it's getting worse. As I said, what we're talking about, 80,000 children being made homeless, welfare benefit cuts. We're talking about making disabled people, forcing disabled people to go to work, and yet there's less and less and less jobs all the time. What's happening is they're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, and it ain't going to fit. And this injustice seems to be just getting worse. But one thing I will say, yeah, really positive that's come out of the whole Occupy movement, which is an amazing thing to spring up right across the world, even in Antarctica. It's funny because I remember every continent except Antarctica has got an Occupy. And you know what? Within 12 hours, they had a bunch of people in Antarctica with a little flag saying, we're occupying this part of Antarctica, yeah? So it was a massive massive movement that spread right across the world. And one of the things that they've done now, many of these camps have been evicted in cities around the Western world. We've had a threat of eviction and people having to leave here in Bristol. And by the way, the City Council, for the first time, have fenced off College Green. What's all that about?
Because I drove past there the other day and I realised that the occupiers have now vacated.
Well, when the City Council, they accused the Occupy people of taking over College Green so people couldn't enjoy it. And what have the City Council now done? They fenced off the whole thing. Even the three quarters of it, which is still perfectly good grass, has also been fenced off. So, I mean, the City Council have to be accused here of total hypocrisy. But the good thing that's come out of this is that there is this kind of movement of people who've got to know each other through the Occupy. And they've been talking and talking. And one of the things that's come out of that is to have anti-eviction squads, which they've now got in the US for the first time, which is where it looks like people are going to get evicted from their homes because they can't afford to pay the rent. They phone up the Occupy people and they'll have a whole bunch of them come around and sleep in their house so that when the bailiffs turn up to take them out of their home the next morning, they're going to be confronted by a whole, shall we say, army of people saying, no, you're not going to evict us. So this is, I think, something really positive that's come out of the whole Occupy movement. And it goes to show that actually there is solidarity around there. In fact, this particular guy I was looking at in the States who said this had happened, this is just before Christmas, was in tears. He said, I was really, you know, worried about where I was going to go. But these people I had never met before, 12 of them came round to my house and they helped me to stay in my own home. And he was in tears. He was cooking for them, you know, making sure they had a nice time. And it's bringing people together who do feel this injustice in groups. I think actually, you know, a tiny number of people can really change the world if they're on the side of the angels, you know, if they're sticking together and they're mates and they understand that they're seeing an injustice going on, somebody being evicted from their home. I mean, if you've seen it in the United States particularly, there are whole areas, for example, of Detroit, which have got perfectly good homes. It's just everybody's been evicted from them and they're starting to fall down. They're crumbling. They've got pigeons in them. They've got all sorts of, they're crumbling. We don't have that in here because squatting is not a criminal offence yet. I mean, Ken Clark, the Justice Secretary, is trying to do so, but it's been delayed and delayed. And, of course, it makes sense for someone to be in a building, say, that's been empty for 6 months, rather than sleeping on the streets, doesn't it? So this is something that's coming out of the Occupy movement. And so even though they're not on College Green, those ideas are unstoppable.
And very quickly, what's your views on the Big Derrick building on Stokes Croft?
Well, this is isn't it a perfect example of the fallacy of massive private property? I mean, it's not the only empty building around, by the way. If you go around the city centre, you will see loads and loads of empty office buildings. In fact, there was a thing in the Evening Post about 10 days ago, our local paper, singing the praises of these beautiful new office buildings and that one of them has got one floor occupied. Well, wonderful. But actually, we don't need any office buildings because the existing office buildings are empty. There's one just opposite the Evening Post, although I don't think the Evening Post had noticed, that it was empty for about 10 years. Now it's got one floor, that is the ground floor, is occupied. The rest of the office building is totally empty.
Where is that?
That is right opposite, I think it's called Castlemead, possibly, right opposite the Evening Post building. If you come out of the reception, look right across the road, you'll see it. Now, it's only the ground floor that's occupied. And, of course, if you're walking past it on the way to get some sandwiches for lunch or whatever, it looks like, oh, this is just a normal thriving building. But you look up and you'll see 8 floors is empty. Now, what I'd love to see is these rents drop for these buildings and these offices be rented out low rent to young people to start up businesses and to get on and do stuff, because we've got a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and expertise in this city, particularly amongst young people. They're raring to go, and I would much rather see them be able to use those offices for very low rents or no rent maybe for the first year, rather than to be sucked into organised crime, because that's the other alternative route, that when austerity kicks in, people are looking around, well, where am I going to make a living? You know, someone's kicked me off the dole, tricked me off the dole. I'm not getting any money from Social Security, so what can I do now? Actually, quite often, the gangsters will get those people, I'm afraid. And so we need to be making sure that they're all legitimate, legal, proper paths for young people to express their creativity and their energy. And in business, you know, so places like, for example, Hamilton House on Stokes Croft is thriving because it's a low rent and But the thing is, there are something like 40 or 50 other buildings around Bristol that could be used to do that. And it's a criminal waste that these places are left empty year after year after year. And that more planning permission is given for more brand new offices and not for necessarily for homes. We need homes as well, don't we? Why are we building offices when we need homes? I don't know. Somewhere along the line, things have got very messed up. The problem, one of the problems is that the people that own these buildings often are exempt from paying business rates. So that building, that office building, just ends up as a bit of money in the bank. And they're not actually having to pay any kind of tax for it. Of course, if you start to tax them, then they start to have to use them. So maybe that's what we should be thinking about doing.
It is indeed the Be Who You Want to Be show. Myself, Junior Saunders, here on Bristol's number one urban station, Ujima 98 FM. And remember, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can visit us online. Our address is www.apprenticeships.org.uk. Or if you want to listen online, it's www.ujimaradio.com. There are three mediums and three ways you can get in contact with this evening's show. You can drop me a text on 07960240198. Apologies, because I did have a few texts coming just a second ago, but the phone has gone. I don't know what's wrong with it. It's just gone completely. You can drop me an email alternatively at 98@ujimaradio.com. If you've got any questions for Tony, this is the prime platform for questions for Tony. If you are a part of a political movement, maybe perhaps you have a political view, or you just want to contribute to the show, it would be really valued. Give me a call, 0117-942-8313. So Tony, what are you up to currently at the moment?
Well, I'm always doing the similar kind of thing, which is trying to figure out what on earth is going on in this crazy world of ours, which is, you know, day to day is changing. I mean, I think, for example, what's going on with Libya, what's going on with now is Syria, what's going on in the Middle East is immensely important to understand. We're living in a world. Now, imagine if you were at the start of World War II, right? Because, of course, they had massive austerity measures. Remember those?
Yep.
Before World War II, in the run-up in the 30s, and a terrible depression, you know, which makes me worried now. If we're in a similar sort of situation, the first thing that starts happening is people start turning on each other. Remember Diane Abbott a few weeks ago?
Yes.
Was talking about, oh, the white man likes to divide and rule. Now, what she really meant to say was the elite, the white elite, likes to divide and rule. And some white men like to divide and rule. But there was a massive, massive attack on her, even by Ed Miliband, who's her supposed boss, phoning her up and saying, you can't say this, Diane. But she's just telling the truth. She's telling it like it is, because this is what happens. And what's happening now is that people who are low paid are being divided and pitted against the unemployed. So you've got people who are in real poverty, and obviously, you know, people who maybe through disablement or whatever can't work. They're being seen as the greedy people. Actually, we know the real greedy people are the super rich who are giving themselves even bigger and bigger bonuses. And in fact, many of these people who can see the economy hitting a brick wall are just taking massive amounts of wealth out of their businesses into their personal accounts as their company goes down. So, you know, we've got a bit of a train crash here. And what's happening is that the powers that be, if you want to call them that, the media manipulators, and the politicians and those of these sorts of interests are trying to pit against these two people, the low paid against the unemployed, and get them fighting each other. And this is exactly what Diane Abbott was talking about.
So what's the end result if that's the case? If that is in
Well, I'll tell you what
plan.
Happens first, and that's you start to get extremism, right? Particularly things like the British National Party. People start blaming someone of a different colour. It's their fault. It's nothing to do with these white bankers in the City of London. It's this black man's fault who's down the road from me. So that's a real danger. And I think we need to be absolutely aware that this kind of situation, these austerity measures that Cameron and Clegg are bringing in, are actually a fertile ground for fascism. Mm. That is to say, you know, people going against each other in their own class. Of course, what we really should be doing is having solidarity between everybody. And I'm not just talking about poor people, I'm talking about everybody. Mm. There's no reason to be fighting each other.
It is a shame, very quickly, just sorry to interrupt. I remember, you know, obviously being grown up with West Indian background, I remember growing up and hearing the stories, you know, from when the immigrants came over in the 50s and 60s and helped rebuild after the war. And, you know, the hatred from, you know, from the English people to the Jamaicans, West Indians, where it was just so crazy and vast. But now it's really strange because the Jamaicans and the West Indians don't really get looked upon as much as the Somalians or maybe the Polish do. So that contrast is very interesting, and it's almost like history is repeating itself.
Well, there is, in a way, there's a quite a normal reason why people will resent immigration now. I think back in the 1960s, it was ridiculous to resent immigration because we had full employment. In fact, employers were begging people to come and work for them. We're in a very different situation now, so people in Britain can see that actually what's happening with immigration now is that it's actually forcing down pay and conditions in various places. We just had, for example, the TV licensing people in Bristol went on strike, and what did Capita do, who employ them? They sacked them, and it almost seems that there's nothing that can be done about that. They just said, oh, sorry, well, the Bristol office is not important with TV licensing anymore. We're just going to get rid of you. We've got another office up in Darlington. So because there's such a massive pool of labour around, people are getting a bit of resentment. Now, of course, the right will use this to try and turn it into a kind of racist thing. You know, that's a real danger. But the other danger is that as things get bad, as things get worse, let's look back to the 30s. It could be a kind of red carpet for the new Hitler. This is the thing that bothers me, is we're creating a situation where, in a bad social situation, almost anybody that comes along starts to look like a saviour if they're changing things. Because, I mean, this is one of the reasons the German people elected Hitler, right? They, in a democratic election, it's because what he was doing was actually sorting out a lot of the austerity problems and making their economy work again. So they saw him as the saviour. Now, this is, I think, one of the real problems with these austerity measures and injustice throughout society, is it could be the paving the way for a new kind of fascism. And I think we just need to be aware of that. So when somebody comes on the scene saying, I can sort all this out, I'm going
Obama.
To be Mr. Wonderful.
Obama.
Well, whoever it could be. Actually, Obama is doing a good job in the US now because he's coming up for another election
in
actually stopping some of the more draconian laws, and he's also starting to force more government spending. I mean, any economist will tell you cannot cut spending for more than 2 years in a row. If you try and do that, your economy is going to hit the buffers. It's going to go down. And I think Obama's realised, look, I do actually want to get re-elected, so he's having to be a good boy. And actually,
do you think he will?
I think it's quite possible, although it's difficult to tell. You start to look at the Republican Party in the US, a lot of these candidates seem to be really crazy people. I mean, I'm talking about cult people like the Mormons. The Mormon Church is, I mean, you know, I think this is another aspect to all of this, is we've got fake religion and we've got real religion. So we've got real Judaism and fake Judaism. I mean, you see the real Jewish people, Orthodox Jews, people that read the Bible, believe in all that kind of thing. And then you've got these kind of Netanyahu types who talk about the Bible. They are the Zionists, but they're not actually really, I don't think, are really into it. You look at the way they act. They don't follow these codes. The other thing is the same in Christianity, and it's the same in Islam, is you get sort of hate preachers. In Islam, you get hate preachers in Christianity, the Christian Zionists. So, you know, it's about understanding that how that whole world is working. And I think, you know, we're able to do that a little bit more all the time. You know, I don't think many people think that Bush and Blair were real Christians.
Yeah.
Do you?
So tell us a bit about Bilderberg then.
The Bilderberg as well. I looked into this group back in the mid-1990s as I finished. I had been working for BBC Radio in London as a researcher on their drive time show, Greater London Radio. And when I came out of working for the BBC, I wasn't able to do the stuff I really wanted to do. I started looking into some things to do with environment and land rights, this kind of thing. Like, I'm really into redistribution of land. We've got 65 million acres of land in Britain, 65 million people. So where's my acre? Yeah? I mean, where's my acre party? And of course, if you've got land, if you've got somewhere to live, you can grow some food, you can put up a shed, you can actually make a living for yourself. If you've got no land, you can't actually even make a start. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're English, then you deserve a part of England. So that's basically where I'm coming from with the Bilderbergers. I did a bit of environmental campaigning. This guy turned up saying, did you know about these Bilderberg chaps? They're running the Western world. Well, I was like, this is ridiculous. Don't be silly. But I dutifully scribbled down in my notebook this name Bilderberg. And when I got back to Oxford, where I was living at the time, I had access to this Reuters article database. So I put into this the Bilderberg word, and out came, because this wasn't available to everybody on the internet, it was just available to me, and all these lists of the rich and powerful came out. So I just instantly just cut and pasted them up on online, and that's how the Bilderberg website started. I mean, basically, these people, they meet once every year. They meet other times of the year, but that's what they're mainly doing. Is that, and they are telling us to trust them. We're having a secret meeting, but we are sorting out everything to do with the economy and world political affairs. Essentially, what they are is a shadow government behind the scenes of the Western world. They pick the many of our leaders. For example, Tony Blair went to one of these meetings the year before he became the Labour leader. Bill Clinton went to one of these meetings the year before he got the Democratic nomination. They seem to be the sort of magic wand kingmakers, and they consist mainly of the people that control most of the money in the Western world, that is the bankers. You know, we're talking about the central bankers, what many people call the gnomes of Zurich, who are the sort of conspiratorial bankers that control the money in the whole of Europe. And but actually, the it's the Tower of Basel. So they're bankers, then the oil people, and a smattering of politicians. And the real clincher is the last meeting. George Osborne went along, our Chancellor of the Exchequer, with his Treasury team to a secret meeting. As far as I'm concerned, he is a democratic man. He should be doing exactly what we tell him to do, and okay, nothing more and less.
Tony, thank you so much. You've been an absolutely brilliant guest. Where can people find you?
Well, you can find the Bilderberg stuff on Bilderberg.org, which is lists of names of all these people and articles. But if you have a look on the Guardian website, a guy called Charlie Skelton has been going to all these for the Guardian Online, these latest few meetings, and he's able to tease out some of the most fascinating stuff to do with the Bilderbergers. He also does it in a very humorous fashion. But, you know, there are many people that have been saying to me, Tony, this is the Illuminati. Yeah, these are these high-level Freemasons from around Europe. And, you know, I would question that, but it's certainly true that the last person to organise one of these meetings in Britain, he was, name is Andrew Palmer. He organised a meeting in 1998 in Turnberry in Scotland, which Blair went to, even though he wasn't on the official list, because I know. He was the private secretary to the world's number one Freemason, the Duke of Kent. So there could very easily be a Masonic connection.
Wow. Okay, Tony Goslin from BCFM there, guys. Very quickly, your show. When can people listen to your show?
Well,
what frequency?
I'm on every Friday drive time, 5 till 7, 93.2 BCFM right across the city. So if you're driving home on a Friday evening, do pick us up. And you can pick up a podcast of all of our shows. We did a special inquiry, by the way, into the 7/7 London bombings. And I'm not in any way convinced that those four guys that were blamed for it actually did it. I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that, for example, they were basically patsies. So that's one of the things you can get on the podcast. And you can find all the podcasts at the BCFM website, or else just go to thisweek.org.uk.
Tony, thank you very much.
Listen live Wednesday at 8 p.m. to be who you want to be. Ujima 98 FM's Apprenticeship Show, brought to you in conjunction with the Western Training Provider Network. Back-